We also occasionally do interviews with postdocs, alumni, or grad students on topical subjects. Are you a grad student, postdoc, or alumni that would like to be interviewed? Visit queensu.ca/sgs/grad-chat to fill out the interviewee form. You can listen to Grad Chat every Tuesday at 4 to 4:30 p.m.
Welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ, and I am your host for this week's a Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if you may miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, I would like to introduce you to Max van Ziel, who is doing a Master of Science in Computational and Theoretical Chemistry under the supervision of Dr. Fanaz Haider Zadar. Welcome to Grad Chat, Max.
Thanks very much, Colette. It's a pleasure to be here.
Computational and theoretical chemistry, that sounds a little bit over the top for me. What made you choose that topic, or that area, sorry, that field of study?
Yeah, I'll mention my father was a big inspiration for me in choosing this, although not directly, in the sense that he was a physicist, a professor of physics. And I remember when I got to Queen's, I was in the general sciences program for my first year, and then you have to decide on a major. And I remember really enjoying chemistry in high school. I thought, I'm pretty good at this. Let me do that. And so, you know, I sign all the forms or whatever it was. I become a chemistry major. And I remember I'm on the phone with my dad saying, hey, I'm doing chemistry as a major. And he goes, chemistry? I want a physics.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
But the undergraduate curriculum in chemistry at Queen's is really heavily focused on the experimental or hands-on side of things.
Right.
Theoretical computational chemistry is kind of a blend of chemistry, physics, math, all in one.
Okay.
And so in a sense, I'm blending my own interest in chemistry with my father's interest in physics.
Well, yeah. I bet that made him a lot happier when you found that.
Yeah, I think it certainly did.
He did that, yeah. Which is great. Well, one of the reasons I wanted to bring Max on is because Max is here to help promote a student-run symposium in honor of the late Dr. Alfred R. Bader. And that's where I think I'd like to go to first, if that's okay, because I know that symposium is coming up. And of course, we want as many people to know about it as possible.
That's the goal. Yeah.
That's the goal. So let me see. You and your colleagues are hosting the Celebrating the Late Dr. Alfred R. Bader 100th Birthday Symposium on Monday, November the 18th. Now, who were you working with, and why did you want to put on this sort of symposium? So I know you're a part of this American chapter of the Chemical Society. Tell me more a bit about that.
Yeah, so the name of the group, it's pretty long. Queen's University International Student Chapter of the American Chemical Society.
That is a bit of a mouthful, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And so let's just stick with QACS from here on out.
Sounds good.
So QACS... this is a student-run group. We've got some graduate students, an undergrad, and a faculty advisor. We operate out of the Department of Chemistry. We look to promote professional development, as well as principles of diversity, equity, inclusion across the chemical community at Queen's and beyond. So Dr. Alfred R. Bader, he was a Queen's alumnus.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people probably, you know, they think about his contributions to the arts at Queen's, for example. We've got Bader chairs in art history, art conservation. We have all these wonderful paintings at the Agnes Reimagined, which is making it rather difficult to get to Chernoff Hall from university.
It is a bit, but it's going to be well worth it.
No, absolutely, it will. So Dr. Alfred R. Bader, he did have this wonderful interest in arts, but before he was able to really kindle that interest, he got his start through chemistry.
Yes.
He began his studies after coming across from Europe as a Jewish refugee during World War II. He did engineering chemistry as an undergraduate here at Queens, as well as some other degrees, including history, and then he did a master's of science in chemistry. He then went on to do a PhD at Harvard and founded what, through a series of mergers, became Millipore Sigma.
Right.
And Millipore Sigma is effectively the Amazon of chemistry.
Right.
So I don't really go through Millipore Sigma because I do all my stuff on computers. But if you want a chemical as an experimental chemist, generally speaking, you're going to be going through Millipore Sigma.
Right, you're going to get it from there.
Absolutely. And so his impact on chemistry has been really transformative. And recognizing this, trying to honor this, given our connection to the Department of Chemistry, and therefore to Dr. Alfred R. Bader, we're looking to put on this symposium in honor of his 100th birthday. Part of our motivation to carry out these various initiatives involving the legacy of Alfred Bader, it's inspired by the fact that I don't think students really, previously at the university, have taken it a stab at doing that.
So what does the American Chemical Society think about this, that you're putting on this symposium?
So the American Chemical Society isn't so involved in this symposium specifically, but we have been dealing with the American Chemical Society over the past 2.5 years regarding this other major initiative, which involves Alfred Bader. So that is the American Chemical Society's International Historic Chemical Landmark Program. So basically what the American Chemical Society, or ACS, looks to do through that program is honor either important people or events with respect to the history of chemistry. And they do this by crafting this custom engraved bronze plaque.
Okay.
And unveiling it at locations related to that person or event.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, and so it was one of the first big projects that QACS took on, again, about 2.5 years ago. And this required us to put together some kind of nomination package saying, you know, why Alfred Bader deserves this thing, why we want to have it here at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, Canada.
Yes.
And initially we got a bit of pushback in terms of, well, Alfred Bader,
Canada.
Well, that's the thing. It's the American Chemical Society, and not to say that they dislike us for being Canadian or anything like that, but they gave us pushback, and I can understand why, in that Alfred Bader, a lot of his work was done out of Milwaukee,
right,
in Wisconsin.
Yes.
And, you know, Bader Philanthropies is headquartered there right now.
Right.
This is where he started his, what eventually became the Amazon of Chemistry.
Yes.
So they gave us some pushback and said, oh, doesn't it make more sense to have it in Milwaukee? And I shouldn't really say we too much in this project, because it has mostly been Dan Reddy, the president of QACS.
Yes, and of course Dan has been on Grad Chat before.
Yeah, he has. And another fellow named Mark McEwen, who was the previous vice president of QACS. I kind of filled his role after he departed.
I see.
So they put in a lot of work to, rather than putting their hands up, say, okay, we're going to come back to you on this. They got a bunch of letters of support saying, we should have this thing here in Kingston. They went to so many different individuals who have various connections to Dr. Alfred Bader.
Right.
You know, I think the first of which is probably Dr. Andy Evans, who's the Bader Chair in Organic Chemistry here at Queen's University. They reached out to people who had won awards in honor of Dr. Bader in organic chemistry from the Canadian Society for Chemistry, or those given out from the ACS. And then I think the cherry on top of the icing on top of the cake was that they were able to secure a letter of support from Daniel Bader, who is Alfred's second son and currently the CEO and president of Bader Philanthropies.
Right.
And with all this firepower of, you know, so many different people are endorsing having this landmark here at Queens, we went back to the ACS, or Dan and Mark went back to the ACS, and they said, okay, fine, you guys make a good point. We're going to approve this. It's on to the next round of review now.
Ooh.
I think the final round of reviews over at the ACS. And it looks like, kind of in an unprecedented fashion, we're going to get a landmark plaque both here at Queens and in Milwaukee. So there will be these two big.
That would be awesome, yeah, if we get both.
Yeah, it really would. As far as I know, that hasn't happened before. And also, as far as I know, students have never led an initiative of this magnitude through the ACS.
Well, it just goes to show how much you all respect Dr. Bader.
Certainly, yes.
Whether you've met him before or not, there's still a huge amount of respect there for Dr. Bader.
Yeah.
So how does this particular symposium that you're putting on support students and postdoc engagement and multidisciplinary collaboration between the sciences and the arts within the Kingston community?
Yeah, so I kind of started off with my ramble about Dr. Alfred Bader. Kind of.
It wasn't a ramble, it was great history.
Yeah, kind of mentioning, you know, he has a big prevalence in the arts here at Queen's. We kind of want to reflect that in hosting this symposium. So Alfred Bader published 2 autobiographies during his life, the titles of which reveal that the 2 most prevailing themes in his life were chemistry and art.
Yes.
QACS recognizes, you know, we're from Chernoff Hall, the Department of Chemistry. We can bring the chemistry side of things. But we also want to honor this huge interest in art that Dr. Bader had.
Yes.
And so we've recruited a series of internationally renowned speakers from both chemistry and the arts. We have recruited students to present posters in a variety of disciplines across science, engineering, and the arts. We've got students giving oral presentations on the day in the big performance hall of the Isabel.
Which is brilliant.
Absolutely. It's gonna present a unique opportunity, I think, for people to network across multiple disciplines, to present in front of audiences that they've never had an experience presenting in front of, getting an opportunity to make these new connections and practice these skills of, you know, getting your work out to a more general audience.
Which is what we're all about.
Absolutely.
Right?
It's very important. And so we look to promote professional development, I think, in that way.
So are you able to tell us some of the notable speakers?
I would be happy to. You know, we've, over the course of however many months ago March was, basically, we've been planning this symposium.
And to be honest, that's not a long time to plan a symposium.
I was thinking about it this morning, and no, it really isn't. And that has kind of required that I work, and also Dan Reddy, the president, we've been kind of going hand in hand in this thing.
Right.
We've been working, probably at least touching on ideas of the symposium 7 days a week since March.
Yeah.
And part of, you know, what we've been doing is strategizing in terms of who do we reach out to and when.
Mm-hmm.
We've kind of built this portfolio of wonderful invited guests, again, internationally renowned, and we look to use these to motivate more people to get on board with the symposium.
Yeah.
So we've got these three keynote sessions during the day, the first of which is the arts keynote session.
Right.
This is going to involve all 3 of the Bader chair positions at Queen's University from the arts side of things.
Fantastic.
So Dr. Stephanie Dickey was the Bader chair in Northern Baroque Art. She only just recently retired.
Yes.
And she moved out to Indianapolis. But,
oh, she did. Oh, yeah. I didn't realize that. That's
but she's going to be coming out to the symposium to give a talk as the former Bader chair in Northern Baroque Art.
Great.
Dr. Govan Bailey, the Bader chair in Southern Baroque Art, is joining. Dr. Aaron Sugar, the Bader chair in Art Conservation, is
Fantastic.
Also going to be in that speaker session. And then lastly, we've got 4 in that first art speaker session. We have Dr. Sven Steinberg, who's an adjunct professor in the Department of History and has done some really exciting work involving Dr. Bader's youth and his involvement in internment camps.
Oh, brilliant.
You know, kind of as a Jewish refugee coming over from World War II.
Right.
You know, for example, he translated the diary that a 15-year-old Alfred Bader kept while he was at an internment camp in Fort Lennox, Quebec, back in, I think, 1940, 1941.
Wow.
He translated it from German to English, and he's going to have some really exciting stuff to say on that front.
Fantastic.
Then, later in the day, after our multidisciplinary poster session, which is going to involve grad students and postdocs, and I think even some undergrads at the Isabel.
And you've got lots of applications for
that? Yeah, we did. It was wonderful.
That's good.
We've got our chemistry keynote speaker session. We've got a Bader chair in organic chemistry. I already mentioned Dr. Andy Evans.
Yes.
He's going to be starting off that session for us. and then two individuals who had written us letters of support for that International Historic Chemical Landmark plaque. First of which was Dr. Rick Tekwinski, who's a professor at the University of Alberta.
Fantastic.
He was the Canadian Society for Chemistry 2023 Alfred Bader Awardee in Organic Chemistry.
Okay.
And then to finish off that session, coming all the way from UC Davis in California, is Dr. R. David Britt, who was the 2023 ACS Bader Awardee in Bioorganic or Bioinorganic Chemistry.
That is brilliant.
It really is. And then after that session, we'll have our Bader graduate student and postdoctoral scholar lectures.
Great.
So from our pool of abstracts, we are able to select three graduate students, one in science, one in engineering, and one in the arts, to give presentations on their work, again, in front of a multidisciplinary audience. And then we've got a non-discipline-specific postdoctoral scholar lecture.
Fantastic.
And then we have and I just keep saying, and then, and it's
I know, but wait, there's more.
Yeah, there is a lot more. Then we've got our exhibition performance slot, as we're kind of slating it. This
makes sense at the Isabel.
Yeah, and that's kind of the inspiration, I think, in a sense, for this part of the day. We've got Dr. Susanna van de Merendonk, who's the Bader Curator of European Art here at the Agnes. And then her sister position, it's the Isabel and Alfred Bader Curator of European Art.
Right.
That is at the Milwaukee Art Museum, and it's held by Dr. Tanya Paul. Now, Dr. Paul and Dr. van de Merendonk have worked together in the past, putting on an exhibition at the Milwaukee Art Museum. And what they're going to do is have this kind of sit-down, intimate chat on the in the performance hall of the Isabel.
Brilliant.
Accompanied by Katia Popliansky, who was, back in 2017, a prize winner at the first of these musical competitions that they hold every 3 years at the Isabel. That first one was a violin competition.
Yes.
And Katia Popliansky, you know, being a prize winner at a competition related to the Baders, she's actually the concertmaster of the Kingston Symphony currently. She's going to come in and join Doctors Paul and van de Merendonk while they chat about that exhibition that they put on, and interject their chat with some wonderful musical performances.
Wow.
And then lastly, you know, after we give everybody some free food in the evening, the pinnacle of, I think, the work that QACS has been doing on the symposium and probably in general, we have successfully recruited Daniel Bader, CEO and president of Bader Philanthropies.
That is amazing.
He's going to be delivering the plenary lecture through the Brockington Visitorship, which is the probably most prestigious public lectureship offered through Queen's University. He's going to be speaking on his experience with Bader Philanthropies. He's going to have some unique insights into the legacy of his father, you know, as his father. I'm extremely excited for his presence at the symposium, but let's not let that take away from the magnitude of the other stuff we've got on during the day.
Well, it's a huge program for one day.
It certainly is.
A huge program, but wow. Okay, so you've given us a taste of what's going to happen.
Yeah.
How can people attend? What's the registration system? Who's it available to?
Yeah, so registration, we want this to be in the same sense that the themes reflected are multidisciplinary. We want the audience to be as multidisciplinary as possible. And that doesn't just restrict us to Queen's University.
Okay.
This is the greater Kingston community, or people across the world, really.
Right.
Registration is open to basically anybody who wants to register. You could be a student, you could be a Kingston community member. Yes, you could have a subscription to the Isabel and you want to come to the Isabel for the event. We're looking to get as many people involved in this thing as possible because we've put a lot of work into it.
Yes.
And we want people to be able to get something out of it as much as we do.
And where do they register?
Yeah, so registration, I would recommend that you just go on the internet and you search up Bader Symposium Queens.
Okay.
And the first links that you'll see are some information pages that have been posted through the university, which then include a link to our website, which will detail all of the registration stuff that you'll need to attend the symposium.
Okay, so you heard it here, folks. So Google Bader Symposium Queens.
Yep.
And you will be able to find out all the details of how to register and be able to attend what sounds like an absolutely amazing symposium, day of lectures and seeing both arts and chemistry, which I love that. I love the fact that there's both of them. So
yeah.
hats off to you and your crew.
Thank you.
I think this is going to be an amazing event for not just Queens, but as you mentioned, the Kingston community. So I hope everyone will get on board and go and have a look at that.
I hope so.
I know after when I get back, I'm going to have to do that myself. So to check my
calendar.
I want
everybody there.
Check my schedule and make sure I don't have any, if I've got any meetings, see if I can move them around so I can attend too.
Because yeah,
that would be awesome. Good luck with all of that.
Thank you.
Before you go, though, I'm not going to let you off the hook that easily because, I mean, you were just amazing how you just rattled off everyone's names and everything. That was fantastic. I do want to ask you in the few minutes that we've got left a little bit about your work. So your research topic is combining quantum chemistry concepts and machine learning for drug discovery. When I'm thinking, okay, there's a lot of big words there for me. But I always find this interesting with this, you know, combination of chemistry and drug discovery and, you know, should this kind of work be done in health sciences or does it stay over in chemistry? So tell us a little bit about what do you mean by combining quantum chemistry concepts and machine learning?
Just touching on that note you made about who should be involved in drug discovery? Should it be chemists? Should it be health scientists? These people, you know, more and more as the world of research evolves, the requirement to be multidisciplinary yourself in terms of your interests, your abilities, these kinds of things, it's becoming more and more important.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really true of my field, I think, especially because I'm not just a chemist. I also have to be a computer scientist, a physicist,
right.
a mathematician, all
yes.
of these things in one. And so those big, scary words aren't there just for fun. Some of the stuff that I'm doing is big and scary, even for me. But to get into the actual topic of what I'm doing, drug discovery throughout history has generally been performed through a more or less trial and error process.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So experimental chemists or whatever researcher it might be, combine some stuff, they come up with a...
See if it explodes or not.
Yeah, that kind of thing. and then, you know, they see, does this work for my desired purpose?
Mm-hmm.
But that can be a pretty costly and time-consuming process.
Yeah. Yes.
And given the development of computational models over the past 100 years or so and the birth of quantum mechanics,
right.
which allows us to understand in almost an exact sense how the physics of nuclei and electrons in your molecules work. Given the development of these computational models and computers, their hardware over this period of time, computational chemistry is becoming more and more of an asset to drug discovery.
Right.
And so you can use, rather than this kind of trial and error, which wasn't just blind trial and error, of course, there was some logic to it, but the idea is that computational chemistry, quantum chemistry, allows you to gain a better insight into what's going on under the hood, basically,
yep.
and then tailor your approach based on that. And so the thing, though, about quantum mechanics, quantum chemistry, is I mentioned trial and error experimental chemistry mm-hmm. is costly in terms of actual money, but quantum mechanics can be both monetarily expensive and also expensive in terms of computer resources.
Right.
So when you start to try to run computational chemistry calculations on molecules beyond, you know, 50 or 100 atoms, which aren't actually that big in the grand scheme of things or interesting in the context of drug discovery, you start to run into memory issues with your computers because you're working with huge matrices
right.
and trying to do very complex mathematical algorithms on these. So quantum mechanics, you know, you can't really use them to determine the energies of proteins that are involved in this drug discovery process.
Right.
And so what people have resorted to in the context of this huge computational cost of quantum mechanics is molecular mechanics. And okay. molecular mechanics basically just uses a simplified view of molecules to
okay.
give you an approximation of what their energy might be, for example. And the thing is, these molecular mechanics, what they're called force fields, they're highly parameterized to be accurate for a small subset of systems in the vast space of chemistry.
Right.
So they'll only really give you accurate, reliable results for a certain class of proteins, for example. But as soon as you feed it a new protein, which it hasn't been parameterized for, its reliability kind of goes out the window.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got this problem of quantum mechanics can give us really great accuracy, but it's extremely computationally expensive.
Right.
And then we've got force fields, which are, using this simplified model, a lot more efficient than quantum mechanics, but the accuracy becomes questionable. And so machine learning hopes to offer a blend between the accuracy of quantum mechanics and the efficiency of force fields.
Right.
And so what it does, in a nutshell, is you will calculate some expensive quantum mechanical data for some data set upon which you're going to train a computer algorithm.
Okay.
And when I say train, I mean basically connect, for example, how does the geometry of this molecule relate to its energy?
Okay, yep.
Using a bunch of different molecules and using my machine learning algorithm, I can get a sense of this geometry gives me this energy. And once I've gotten a good, robust performance on my training data set of molecules, I can hopefully say that my machine learning algorithm has learned something about chemistry, quote unquote. And then I take it and I evaluate its performance on a set of molecules that it hasn't seen before.
Okay.
And hopefully its accuracy will remain.
So if you find that it still remains,
yep.
Do you then go to the physical chemists and say, try this? Because at the moment it's just a model. It's on a computer.
Yeah, certainly. It is just a model right now. And my work per se isn't exactly about extracting the most useful information out of these. It is kind of building these mm-hmm. models and ensuring that their accuracy transfers well from that training set to the test set.
Right.
But yeah, that is the idea, is then once we've developed these models, we've trained them on learning about a wide array of chemical subspace.
Right.
Ideally, then we can hand this off to a physical chemist and say, this will give you accurate, an accurate quantification of the materials that you're dealing with.
Right.
Hopefully, it's accurate like quantum mechanics, efficient like force fields. Hopefully, this will be a useful tool for your drug discovery efforts.
Brilliant. Lots to it.
There is a lot to
it. You're going to have to come back on the show because we've run out of time. But you're going to have to come back on the show and explain a little bit more about this because it's a little, as you said, a little scary.
Yeah.
A big challenge. And I'd love to hear a bit more about it.
And I'd love to tell you more.
That's great. In the meantime, though, Max, enjoy the symposium. Remember, everyone, just Google Beta Symposium at Queen's and you'll find out how to register. And I hope to see lots of you there because it's going to be an absolutely awesome day. And good luck with the day. Well done with all the work that you and your colleagues have put in to get this in place. It's a great honor, I'm sure, for the betas that you've thought about them in this way. And what a great way for your Queen's chapter of the American Chemistry Society, as well as Queen's, to honor what a wonderful family and the philanthropy that they've done for our school and for our students and everyone. So thank you for coming on the show and explaining all of that. And again, I hope we will see a lot of people there.
Thank you very much, Colette. Those are very kind words. I appreciate it. Looking forward to the symposium and continuing with my research.
And then you'll be going at the end, because I know it's exhausting.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
But enjoy when the day comes. Make sure you enjoy it too.
Yeah, I will.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
CFRC's funding drive is now underway and running through December 31st. Donate today and get amazing CFRC prizes. For every $5 you donate, earn a ticket towards one of our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from wonderful local businesses, including Harper's Burger Bar, Hotel Wolf Island, Improbable Escapes, Kingston Canadian Film Festival, KPP Concerts, Long & McQuaid, Martello Alley, and Novel Idea. Enjoy the benefits of donating. Give today via cfrc.ca.
Sego.
Buju Anim.
Danach A. At Anzenu Shukwithan.
Tante.
Hey, Inuhalikai.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Hi, I'm Christine Genier. Welcome to Words and Culture, the Athabascan episodes. Shan Shaklin Ayenji Danke, Akanzenu Shokwithan. Athabascan is the name given to the Dene languages on Turtle Island. You will hear these languages from Alaska through the Yukon, Northwest Territories, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Alberta, Manitoba, and then a jump down into Navajo country. It is a categorization given by anthropologists and linguists. There are many different dialects within each language group, and then even sub-dialects or regional dialects within the major ones. Our dialects tell those who hear the language where we are from and who we are from. Nowadays, it can tell them who you are learning from. Just a certain inflection or the addition of a consonant or vowel in a word can place you. And while we have different languages within the Athabascan group, those languages have common or root words. For instance, sho, cho, shro, some variation thereof, I have found often means big or good or grand, maybe old. It depends on the context of the word. Even the word dene, dena, dan, have a very common sound, and it all means people. In the Yukon, 7 of the 8 Indigenous languages are categorized as Athabascan. In this episode, we talk about Gwich'in language, or Dinji-Ju-Ginjik. Dinji-Ju-Ginjik is spoken in Alaska, Yukon, and Northwest Territories. This episode will include a short conversation that I had with my dear friend Bobby Rose Cooey about adventure tourism and her business, Dinji-Ju Adventures. First, Brandon Kikievichik is from Old Crow, Yukon. Brandon works in Gwich'in language recovery. I got to know Brandon as part of a working group building curriculum around Indigenous language transfer with the Yukon Native Language Center. Now, when we talk about language recovery work, that is to say we are helping each other remember. This language is with us. It is within us. We heard it around us, and it was spoken to us. To work in language recovery is to recover the language within, but also for the public space and the world around us. It is to hear it reflected in popular culture and education, at work and at home. I really enjoy speaking with Brandon about language work. He is generous with his teachings and doesn't concern himself a lot with what doesn't serve that work. He is intricate in his description of language in general, not just Indigenous languages, and he tells a really good story. A warning before we move ahead, this episode discusses suicide and residential school abuse.
My name is Brandon in English. My last name is a Gwich'in name. It comes from my great-grandfather, Kikavichik. It means, may I carry the arrow. And then my first mentor, he gave me the name of Dinjivikwichie, which is it's kind of a joke, but it means that even like easy or simple things come hard to me, but he named me the opposite though. What he means by it is that everything comes easy to me, and that's like supposedly like a normal way of naming people sometimes. Back in the old days, you name them the opposite of what they are. I guess it's sort of like how you, like nowadays you would call a big guy tiny sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's kind of like that, I guess.
Where is home for you? Where are you from?
Old Crow, but the proper name for it is Taychik. Taychik just means the mouth of the river, because it's right at the mouth of the Crow River, which leads into Crow Flats. And Crow Flats is called Van Thot, and we're called Van Thot Gwich'in. So we take our name from the Van Thot as a wetland. And that river, the Crow River, which leads into Crow Flat, the mouth of that river is called Taychik. And that's the real name of Old Crow.
Is that where you grew up? Is that where your younger years took place?
Yep, grew up there. And then when I was 15, I was supposed to go to high school, but my dad died suddenly. He got sick, actually, and I spent like a month with him at the hospital in Yellowknife. And that was right around the time I was supposed to be going to high school. So I ended up not going to high school in grade 10, and I spent a year trapping with my grandfather out in the bush. And I knew that I could either go to school and learn from Oom Jits, or I could stay in Old Crow. And, you know, my grandfather was in his twilight years at the time. I could spend those years with him and learn from him, and that was what I was going to do. But my teachers in Old Crow were very harshly against that, and they really, really wanted me to continue my education because they saw potential in me, I guess. Mm-hmm. And they convinced me to go to school. So when I was 16, I came out here for school and then went to college and did all that stuff too, so.
Did you always have that Dunk Eko She on your tongue? Was it always there?
I think so. I was always top of the class in Gwich'in class in school. We had like Gwich'in class in school. I was always top of that class. My grandfather always spoke to us in our dialect. And so at first I could only hear our dialect. I couldn't hear anyone else's dialect. Now I could hear any dialect now, but at the time I could only hear ours. But I think the fact that I could only hear our dialect actually proves that I must have had some of it in me already or something. Because what would happen would be, like, when I first started working, we started with a blank Word document, a 1960s tape recorder, and my elder. And then we just put the tape in of elders telling stories in Gwich'in, and we wrote it out in the Gwich'in language. And so when we were doing that at first, the first tape we put in, I was utterly surprised. I could not hear what she was saying at all. And I was so surprised because I was working with Joel before that. Anytime there would be something going on with the kids at school or something like that, it would be me and Joel. Like, there was one time when they made movies in the language, and so me and Joel helped them write their scripts. Mm-hmm. And so we worked together. So when Joel spoke the language to me, he's my grandfather's nephew, so he speaks the same dialect, so I could hear it perfectly. And then I was utterly surprised. I put the tape in and I couldn't hear what she was saying. And it turned out she was speaking a different dialect. So what Joel had to do is I would put the tape in, I would press play. He'd sort of hold his hand over the tape recorder like this, and he'd like look up into the air and he'd absorb the words, and then he'd wave his hand around when he wanted me to push stop. And then I'd push stop, and then he would say it in our dialect, and then I would hear it and I'd be able to write it. And so I think that shows that I must have had it like in me already or something, because I wouldn't have been able to hear our dialect, and there wouldn't have been that discrepancy between another person's dialect and our dialect. I should have not been able to hear anything. I should not have been able to hear my dialect or the other dialect, but for some reason I could only hear our dialect. So it must have been, I think, probably because the language was spoken around my mother. And my mother was fluent too while she was pregnant with me. Mm-hmm. Might have had something to do with it. So, you know, pregnant mothers out there, if you want your kids to learn your language, try to make sure it's spoken while you're pregnant, because I think there's a chance they might be hearing it.
Uh-huh, yeah. So you're talking about Joel. This is your grandfather's nephew.
Yeah.
And he was helping you. He was helping you do this language recovery work.
Yeah. At first he was. Yeah. And then he passed away tragically, taking his boat out of the river. I just happened to be there at the time too, and you know, he didn't exactly die right in front of me, but you know, he was laying there on the road after the accident right in front of me, and then he got medevaced out and he passed away in Vancouver. And I was still a drug addict at the time, and I took it pretty hard, and it was 3 months after my nephew committed suicide too, my nephew who I got out of the group home and was, you know, trying to raise on my own. He committed suicide, then Joel passed away, so it was a rough time for me, and I went deep into the drugs and the alcohol. And then Marion, she told that story to our group the other day, how she saw what I was going through and how hard I was taking it. Mm-hmm. And that's when she approached me and she said, you know, I see how hard you're taking Joel's death, and, you know, if you want to keep working with the language, I can help you, she said. Mm-hmm. And that's when me and her started working together. And then pretty soon my uncle Irwin, he got on because Marion and I were having extreme difficulty translating the old language. The reason why I worked with Joel is because Joel got held back from residential school. And so while he would have been in residential school learning from Om Jits, instead, he was living with my great-grandparents, his grandparents, and he was living with them, traveling the land with them, absorbing their stories through the sparkle in his eyes.
Yeah.
And for that reason, he was able to understand that old language. And so when me and Marion started, we were having extreme difficulty understanding that old language. So we had to bring Irwin in, because Irwin, although he had to go to the non-status school because his dad was, I don't want to talk too much about that, but he went to the non-status school but when he got back, he was raised by my great-grandfather's oldest sister, who was born approximately sometime in the 1870s or whatever, out in the bush at a caribou fence village. And she was raised at that caribou fence village in her formative years and never saw a white person until she was in her late teens. And so Irwin knew that old language. So eventually Irwin came on with us to help us so that we could translate that old language. Caribou fences were cooperative efforts by our people, and they cooperated together, and they built what I would refer to as corrals. They're sometimes referred to as corrals. Mm-hmm. They're built out of wood. And where we are at the time, we were a little above the tree line. Where the caribou fences are above the tree line a little. And so a lot of that wood was imported. So they dragged that wood cross country to build those caribou fences where they built them. They're usually anywhere from 3 kilometers long to 8 kilometers long, and I've heard of some as long as 17 kilometers. And they were used to guide the caribou into giant traps. What they would do is he explained it really good in that story that I read yesterday. That was the story that I read yesterday. That was a man who was raised with his grandfather, and his grandfather was raised at a caribou fence too. His grandfather was orphaned, and this guy who ran the caribou fence, he took in orphans for his workforce. And that's how his grandfather ended up working on a caribou fence, so that's why he knew so much about it. And he explained it really good. You know, they wait in those valleys, those big valleys are called Unkitchungoe. We heard those Unkitchungoe are big, long valleys, and they have lots of feeder creeks that run into them, and they're up in the mountains. Mm-hmm. Those are good hunting areas. Long ago, the leader would develop the plan, and then they'll walk through that valley for miles, And he sends people up the most important creeks, hunters. And they go up all the creeks all the way up that valley, and they hunt as much caribou and moose as they can get for that's preparing for winter. And so those valleys like that, there's caribou trails going through those valleys. That's where they built those caribou fences. Mm-hmm. And they would, when the caribou, they wait in that big valley, and when they see, they have watchers on high peaks. When they see the caribou coming, there's a, like the way Alfred was explaining it, that there must be like a certain point they don't want them to get past. Because if they get beyond that point, you're not going to be able to flush them into the area you want to flush them into. So what you have to do is get there ahead of them and intercept them. And then once you intercept them, then you flush them into the area that you want them to go into. Mm-hmm. And once they get into that area, that's when they're going to hit that center fence. And that center fence is going to lead them right into the pocket of the trap. And that pocket of the caribou fence is where the snares are set. There's snares made of animal for people who don't know what snares are. I guess you could call it a noose, I guess.
Yeah.
It's like a noose, and it's like made of babiche. It's made of caribou skin. Caribou go in there and they get caught in the snares, and then they kill them with spears. And then they drag them out of the caribou fence really quickly, and they drag them to a butchering shack. And then everything is cleaned up good right away too. They don't let the blood stay there for very long. They clean it all up good right away.
So you want to find out more about that, people are going to have to come and know how to ask for that knowledge too. Where you're from and where I'm from, they call this territory now Yukon Territory. Where I'm from, they got that big highway just landed right on us, right? The Alaska Highway. Where you're from, people still have to have an airplane or a boat, or a, not a boat, that's I'm thinking maybe Juno now, an airplane, boat from other,
We boat to other communities, yeah.
Oh, that's, yes, you do, you go Fort Yukon, So boat or airplane or other ways to get there, but not a highway, not for a car. Do you think, Brendan, that that has helped keep your way in your language?
I think the isolation definitely helped, for sure, no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. But we're in a fairly dire situation too when it comes to the language. We may be a little ahead of some other communities, but not that far ahead. Mm-hmm. And we're still in a pretty scary place, but there's lots of good stuff going on there. There's a girl, a woman up there, Sophie Flather, who's doing amazing stuff. Her son speaks Gwich'in just as good as Dingy Zhukiu. Her son speaks Dingy Zhukiu just as well as he speaks English. Mm-hmm. And the things that they're doing with like immersion and language nests and stuff like that, it seems to be making a big difference, because, you know, even the elders are telling me they're starting to see kids speak the language around town and stuff like that, which is really nice to see. Mm-hmm. So I think definitely the isolation definitely like kind of benefited us in that sense. But we're in a pretty tough spot too.
Some of the tough spots, those challenges, do you think, how were you impacted by other societies coming up there and saying, okay, now you have borders, right? So if you look on a map, those maps they made for us now, we have the Yukon, and then next door we've got NWT, and we got Gwich'in there, but then there's that border there now. And on the other side, we got even not just a different territory, but now they've got a whole different country on that side. What did that do to the community?
This is a very, very heavy subject you're talking about here. We have a very long history with it. It's kind of hard to talk about.
Okay.
There were conspiracies, epidemics, relocation, manipulation of my people, racism, all of that stuff. It all happened. They completely severed One of the most powerful structures that we have in our culture, which is our familial structure. And there was absolutely no borders or nothing like that. And we had people who are from now modern day Alaska running caribou fences in our traditional territory, and their families are now Vantat today. And that was the norm back then. We all just worked and shared together, and you could live in any country you want, and you're going to have relatives there too. There was nothing like what we have today. So I thank you for bringing that up, Masih Cho, and I'm glad to be able to speak on it. But that is a very heavy subject, and that is a very, I mean, I'm probably going to write a book on that subject, actually. So that would be a very long conversation.
I want to ask you if you could let one, if you ever felt like, I just want the rest of the world to know one thing about this language up here. What do you know what that might be?
If I were to compare it to, like, say, English, for instance, mm-hmm. So when you're trying to communicate something, you're trying to paint pictures in people's minds, or you're trying to put a picture in a person's mind when you're trying to communicate something. In English, you'd imagine that we're creating that picture in the person's mind using puzzle pieces, because English is an analytic language. So you can put it all together with puzzle pieces, then you can take it all apart, you can analyze it, put it into these rigid structures and all that. That's analytic. Our language, being polysynthetic, would be when we're putting pictures in people's minds, when we're communicating, it's more like brush strokes, and it's more like painting a picture than it is puzzle pieces and analytical. It's on the opposite side of the spectrum, which makes it a little more difficult to learn, but it also gives it a sense of beauty that you might not find in analytic languages.
Do you feel okay sharing, teaching me one phrase in your way?
Wow. I wouldn't know what to choose. this is not like a beautiful word or poetic or anything like that, but it's a word I like to share. Dal-tsyak. Yeah. So dal-tsyak, two syllables, right? Two, dal and tsyak, right? I want to make it for myself.
Oh.
Seven words in English and two syllables. Right, the ta is the benefactive, for the benefit of oneself. The L is the L classifier, that means I'm doing it. Tsya would be in the future mode. But you're not talking in the future mode, you're talking in the optative. I want it, or I may, or whatever, let's, right? That's the optative. So instead of pronouncing that tsya, you cut it off, that elongated vowel, you cut it off with a glottal, and it becomes tsya, and that gives you your optative. Uh-huh. So in one word, you've got the benefactive, the L classifier, and the optative. Two syllables, seven words in English. That's why I like to share that one. It shows how different our languages.
Thank you for talking to us today, Brendan.
Yeah.
That was Brendan Kiakevichik talking about language work and Gwich'in living, including the technology required to survive millennia. Millennia on top of millennia. In the most rugged environment this planet has to offer. Thank you, Brendan, for that great talk. I ran into my friend Bobby Rose Cooey the other day. We were both enjoying the spring weather after a long, dark winter. Bobby Rose is Tetlik Gwich'in from Fort McPherson, Northwest Territories. She is the owner-operator of Dingy Zhu, an adventure tourism business which provides a land-based experience on the river immersed in language and culture. I asked Bobby Rose, how's business?
Dingy Bobby Rose, Kui Village, Tetlik Gwich'in, Ithli Tetledje, Gwijit, White Brazil, Kongwitia, Tsutsukat, Rosemary Kui, Transit, Dorothy Alexei Tsitsik had Abraham Kuth Sr. Chansat Jin Green. So good afternoon. My name is Bobby Rose Kui. I'm Tetlet Gwichin, Main and People of the Headwaters. I was raised in Fort McPherson, Northwest Territories, but I reside here on the Tan and Kwalandan traditional territory. I own a adventure guide company called Dinjiju Adventures. Dinjiju Adventures. Well, we offer river trips throughout the north. My first 5 years running Dinjiju Adventures, I'm hosting river trips for northern communities. When I'm not doing that, I'm offering trips to guests who are coming into the territory.
What goes on these adventure trips?
Usually most of the trips I like to host and guide are multi-day river trips in remote areas like the Peel Watershed. On a daily basis, those trips look like waking up early to a cup of coffee on one of the banks of the Northern Rivers. Wake up to coffee and breakfast made by us. And we'll gather together, share breakfast among the mountains and by the river, by our friends. And once we're done breakfast, we'll start our journey on the river for a few hours, paddling down these beautiful rivers. And then we'll find a really beautiful lunch spot with beautiful views, usually where we'll have time to gather everybody and share some stories about those areas. After lunch, we'll continue on to find our camp spot for the night, where we'll get set up and cook a beautiful supper, set up our tents, enjoy the evening, and learn more about each other, but also learn more about the places that we're in. A lot of Indigenous peoples have been traveling on water or by water or near water for thousands and thousands of years. And over the last 50 to 60 years, more in these remote areas, we're seeing less of our people travel. And for me to go back to these places where like my grandfather traveled, or my grandparents and their grandparents before them, it's pretty magical. And it makes me wonder about how they lived and how they traveled, and you know, being able to share the same words of the names of mountains and be able to share those stories as well is like something that makes me who I am and makes me stronger as a Gwich'in person.
Do you include a lot of language work?
Yeah, it's usually, it's really important to include language. And you know, there might be not be another Gwich'in person on the river, but I make sure that I'm using it daily, like I use it today and like every other day. But it's also important for me to learn language from other people who are out on the river, because I feel like I get to know people more personally once I know and understand how they speak mm-hmm. and how they share their love. And when you speak the language, it's kind of a form of love.
What a beautiful way to describe it. It's a form of love. Dank e koshe is a form of love. Where can someone look for more information about your business?
I have social media along with the website. You could find a lot of information on Google. You could hear more of my stories that have been recorded on other places online as well, right from when I started to recently. There's stories on my website from youth who've been on trips. And yeah, I think the best way to learn more about these trips is to come on them.
That was Bobby Rose Kui talking about her business, Dinjiju.
To find out more, go to her website at dingizhuh.com, DINJIIZHUH.com. I'm Christine Genier. Soko seni denat e. Take good care out there.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin. Soko Se.